This is a download from the University of Virginia. The following is the October 14th edition of the More Than the Score lecture series. In a moment, UVA law professor Ted White will discuss baseball at the crossroads. But first, here's acting director of university outreach, Megan Raymond.
I'm just going to say a couple of words and then we'll move on to the talk. My name is Megan Raymond. I'm the acting director of university outreach here at the University of Virginia. And it's really my pleasure to welcome you to the inaugural season of More Than the Score, which is the University of Virginia's pregame lecture series. Just a couple of quick thank yous and announcements. First and foremost, I'd like to thank Mr. Ted White for volunteering his time to come and speak with us. All the faculty in our series volunteer their time to come and talk to alumni, parents, and friends. So special thank you to Ted. Also, I'd like to thank the Alumni Association, who's our co-host for this series. They make all the arrangements, made arrangements for heaters this morning, which was wonderful. We were all sort of thinking about that last night, watching the temperature go down. Just to give you a heads up on what lies ahead for the rest of the football season, on Saturday, October 28th, we have two faculty members from our Institute on Aging, Tim Salthouse and Art Weltman. We'll be talking about healthy bodies, healthy minds, not limited to just senior citizens. I hate to break it to you, but we're all aging. We can all use some tips on how to fight the course of nature, and we'll hear some great things from them. I'm also thrilled to say just yesterday I spoke with Mr. Alec Horniman from our Darden School. He is going to be giving a talk on November 18th. Applause already. I'll have to call and tell him. He's going to be talking about habits for leadership excellence, choice or chance. That's basically the idea is that so much of leadership skills are predetermined, but Mr. Horniman will be talking about how to make the right choices in the right time to really move forward on high-performance leadership. So just put that on your schedule as well. And again, November 18th, Saturday morning, bagels, coffee, 10 a.m., same bat time, same bat channel. Just like to take a quick moment here to talk about the University of Virginia's commitment to educational engagement. And many of you have heard me mention this several times as you've started to come to this series. But really, I think one of the great things that this series reminds me of is how we all share a spirit for lifelong learning. Charlottesville community members, UVA alumni, parents and friends, and sports fans. We can all come together, learn a little something, and then head out to have some great fun this afternoon. I know a couple of folks were asking if there was going to be a quiz at the end of the talk today. I know, laugh if you will. There will not be a quiz, but you do have an assignment. I always encourage our audience members to listen to our speaker and come up with an excellent question for him at the end of the talk. He has left time in his comments today for question and answer. So you do need to think of a good question over the next 30 minutes or so. That said, it's my pleasure to introduce President and CEO of the Alumni Association, Mr. Tom Falders, who will be introducing our speaker today. Tom.
Thank you, Megan. The reason we're not having a quiz is we couldn't find enough blue books, so we want to thank Megan and the Provost Office for working with us to produce More Than the Score. As Megan indicated, we're doing this at 10 o'clock every Saturday morning where we have a Saturday football game. So, parenthetically, we're not doing More Than the Score next Thursday night with the North Carolina game, okay? I'd also like to thank the UVA Club of Houston, who has made a donation for this program in recognition of the tireless efforts expended by Dean Ed Ayers on behalf of the college and the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences. Now you may be wondering, you're all here for a football game, you may be wondering why we're talking about baseball. Baseball, as you know, starts generally in the February timeframe with spring training, goes through most of the summer, and we just happen to be at a time where we're having the championship playoffs. And soon we'll have the World Series. And we thought it would be very timely to address to you today somebody who's an expert on baseball. He played baseball when he was young. He didn't quite get to the majors, but that experience gave him an abiding love for the sport. Now, he decided to do something else. He's been a professor of law at the university since 1972. He's written many books. He's been on many boards. He's been head of the Virginia Law, or been on the editorial board of the Virginia Law Review for many, many years. A distinguished professor, and one that the students have always said is one of their favorites. So let me introduce Ted White.
Thank you. I've titled this talk Baseball at the Crossroads, and you might wonder what the crossroads are and why I'm implying that baseball has some hard decisions ahead at a time when the ballparks are, to some degree, full. Any winning team that wins consistently, fills up the stands, even though the prices of games are quite high. And the television rights packages are increasing. Every time there's a renegotiation of a contract between Major League Baseball and one of the networks, the price goes up. So the labor situation in baseball is stable at the moment. There is a December 19th deadline for a new collective bargaining agreement, but nobody really anticipates that there's going to be any particular labor problems. The latest agreement seems to be working at some level, although I'm going to talk more about what I think are some economic issues that baseball isn't fully confronting. The popularity of the sport remains comparatively high, although it's certainly the case that if you compare the baseball situation in 2006 with its situation 50 years earlier, other sports have significantly encroached on baseball's preeminence. And I think most significantly, young children in the school systems and in communities are not playing baseball to the extent they were 50 years ago. When I was in high school in that period, the sports that were typically offered for most high schools were football, basketball, and baseball. There were no women's sports. Those sports were perceived as exclusively male sports. But sports that were typically not offered included soccer and lacrosse, which are sports that are now, and tennis, which are sports that are now regular, and swimming, which are sports that are now regularly part of the high school program. Indeed, I've argued in the book that I wrote in 1996, Creating the National Pastime, that baseball is not an attractive sport for young people to play in some respects, particularly because baseball concentrates its action on a batter and pitcher while other players stand around. For young people, it doesn't have the kind of opportunities for motion on the field and a feeling of participating that, let's say, soccer does. Baseball also has the difficulty, from a young person's perspective, of having the crowd's attention and the player's attention riveted on pitchers and batters or infielders when they're making infielders and outfielders while they're making plays. Baseball is a difficult game to play, as anybody who has taught children to play it knows. It is a hard ball. It is a relatively small bat. Fielding a baseball is not an intuitive gesture. It has to be trained. Hitting a baseball is not intuitive. Most people are not good at it. Most young children are not good at it. And so what most young children do in a baseball game when they're playing at, let's say, the middle school level, is they fail publicly. They fail in front of other people. They strike out, they make an error, they throw the ball away, a ball goes through their legs. Compare that, let's say you're talking about 9 or 10-year-olds. Compare that with soccer, where 9 or 10-year-olds run around on a field in a largely anonymous way, and then perhaps some gifted players break out of the mass and shoot on the goal. But while this is going on, while the soccer teams are preparing action on the field, nobody is really being stigmatized in the way that people are stigmatized if you strike out in an important time of a game with everybody watching. So I think it's no accident that in this community and many communities across the country, soccer has become the reflexive sports activity that professional people introduce their children to. And so we have Saturday morning soccer games instead of Saturday morning baseball games, which was the case in my day. So this has ramifications that go well beyond what children do for entertainment when they're growing up. Baseball is a sport where one needs to play it a lot and pick up increased tips and execute those tips and practice as one goes along. And if you're not introduced to the sport at an early age, then when are you going to be introduced to it? And so where is the cadre of potential players coming out of the ranks of young people that will be interested in going on and playing baseball in high school or college? So in that sense, the sport has settled into a position where it's just one among many offerings for young people, and there's no particular reason to think that young people and their parents are going to be attracted to baseball as opposed to other sports. Just one final word in this. Baseball, the skills that are associated with good performance in baseball are to some extent gender related. I don't mean to suggest that women are not capable of being good baseball players, and some girls are beginning to show up on high school teams. But baseball remains a game in which strength and a particular kind of quickness are quite important. And compare it with soccer. Soccer skills, although men and women players begin to distinguish themselves around the ages of 9 or 10, and co-ed teams evolve into single-sex teams, women are quite capable of playing soccer at a very high level in the same manner that they're capable of playing tennis or golf at a very high level. But we haven't seen any female baseball players going up into the major leagues. That's another disadvantage, because women and girls are now involved with athletics from a very early age, and if baseball's not an attractive alternative to females, then that's another reason why young people wouldn't necessarily play it. So I think baseball has some real, what you might call, recruitment issues. But I want to concentrate on three other sorts of issues that face the sport at this juncture in its history. The first is the economic state of the game. Now, I said earlier that the labor situation is at present quiescent, and there has been an agreement in which there is a certain degree of sharing of revenues across the major league franchises. There's a so-called luxury tax, which is assessed on teams that have revenues beyond a certain period, and that tax is distributed among other franchises. So it is a little easier, because of the luxury tax, it's a little easier for franchises like Kansas City that have a relatively small population base and comparatively poor TV rights, it's a little easier for franchises like Kansas City to compete with franchises like Los Angeles or New York. But it's still difficult. It is still the case that the so-called large market franchises, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, have overwhelmingly more purchasing power in the marketplace than do the so-called small market teams. The term large market may not fully be understood. It is not a function exclusively of the size of a metropolitan area. The Philadelphia Phillies, for example, are only recently what you would call a large market team. And that's because their ownership is more affluent and prepared to spend some money. It's also because the TV rights to their games have gone up. But large market is determined not just by the size of the audience for attending games, but primarily by the size of the audience for watching games on television and listening to them on the radio. That is what made the Los Angeles Dodgers and the San Francisco Giants such successful franchises after they left Brooklyn and New York to go to the West Coast. They tapped in on the television rights to a very large area. You remember San Diego did not have a team for many years. Oakland is an expansion team. Seattle was not present. When the Dodgers and Giants went to the West Coast, they got a bonanza of television rights. The Yankees have the highest revenue from television rights of any of the teams. That's not just a function of the fact that they're in a large metropolitan area. It's a function of the fact that being the Yankees, they have a certain cachet, and so cities from New England will pick them up as a television package, and add to the revenue. Well, what's the problem with having some franchises, so-called large market, and some franchises, small market? The problem is that free agency is the norm in baseball today, and that means that nearly all players will have contracts that are deliberately set up by their agents to expire after a certain period of time. Sometimes just a year, more commonly 2 or 3 years, but very rarely a long-term contract. And when those contracts expire, the player is then released from the service for that particular club and goes on what's called now the free agency market. Players have learned, since the baseball has had free agency, that you go on the market, hopefully, right after you've had a good year. Doesn't always work out that way, but there are very strong incentives for players to play well and assess good statistics in their year just before free agency. There are also very strong incentives for players to negotiate their terms of their next contract in their free agency year, even if they've been a successful and beloved player for a particular team. There are some exceptions. Cal Ripken, for example, came up, his free agency contract expired at least 2 and perhaps 3 times while he was with the Orioles. But he did not want to leave the Orioles. His father had been a manager in the Orioles organization. The Orioles didn't want him to leave, and so the two negotiated a continuation. But the Cal Ripken case is increasingly unusual, and a more typical case is the case of Johnny Damon, who came to the Red Sox and was a pivotal figure at a time when the Red Sox finally won a championship and then the World Series. And Damon not only leaves the Red Sox, he goes to the Yankees, the Red Sox a chief rival. So free agency means that each time a star player ends the terms of his contract, the large market teams are in a position to outbid the small market teams for getting players on the roster. And they repeatedly do. The case of Alfonso Soriano with the Washington Nationals is going to be interesting. The Washington Nationals have a limited payroll still for three reasons. First, because when they were the Montreal Expos, Major League Baseball was interested in getting rid of the franchise and so gave them a limited budget on the theory that why should this franchise spend a lot of money if it's going to be contracted? Secondly, the Nationals moved to Washington at a time when they were in an old stadium where they were not supposed to be a particularly strong team, and they were a much stronger team last year than they were this year, but they finished last in the division in both years. And so the idea that they could draw a lot of fan base in this initial period was problematic. And then finally, the Nationals didn't have a good TV contract. Indeed, their TV rights were controlled by the Baltimore Orioles as part of the package by which Peter Angelos agreed to let the Expo franchise be moved to Washington. So the Washington is, notwithstanding the size of the Washington area, Washington would have to be described as a small market team. Alfonso Soriano is in his free agency year, and he had a sensational year this past year, hitting more than 40 home runs, stealing more than 40 bases, being a spectacular player. Will the Nationals attempt to sign Soriano for market rates? Because that's what it's going to have to take to sign it. The fact that Soriano is a very sought-after player on the free agent market means that other franchises are going to offer him a great deal of money. Will the Nationals match that? If they do, they'll then have limited opportunities to sign other high-priced free agents. Indeed, they'll have limited opportunities to pay their own players because they're still a small market franchise. Well, the result is it's certainly a better than 50-50 chance, perhaps maybe something like a 70-30 chance, that Alfonso Soriano will leave the Nationals and go to a large market team. This means that franchises like Pittsburgh, like Kansas City, like Oakland, like Minnesota, have to every year scratch together a roster based on lower priced talent. One of the reasons that this phenomenon is concealed is that baseball is such an unpredictable sport. You can get a team sort of cadged together on a low budget like the Oakland Athletics or the Detroit Tigers, and they have a particularly inspired year and they end up playing in the American League Championship Series. So that may foster the impression that spending a lot of money on players doesn't matter. But it goes well beyond that, because spending a lot of money on high-priced free agents enhances the visibility of the team, whether or not the team does well. And that means that your TV package is more attractive. So unless and until baseball addresses the adverse consequences of free agency and the large market, small market phenomenon, it's not at all clear there's going to be competitive balance in the sport. It's no accident that the Yankees contend nearly every year. It's no accident that the Pittsburgh Pirates almost never contend, or the Kansas City Athletics. They don't have the resources to get high-priced free agents. The National Football League has addressed this issue, and very successfully, with its revenue sharing. Can you imagine if the National Football League had the situation that baseball has, how the Green Bay Packer franchise could survive. And Green Bay Packers Green Bay is a very small town. So the National Football League has been, as Pete Rozelle used to say, socialistic in its approach to the market. The difficulty with instituting the National Football League model in baseball is not that it wouldn't work. It's that the players' union in baseball is very entrenched. That's a historical phenomenon which comes out of the fact that at one point baseball players had no rights. Under the reserve clause, they could be cut from the roster if they didn't sign the terms that the management offered, and they could be prevented from playing for any other team. When the reserve clause was eliminated and free agency emerged, it was because there was a very strong players' union led by Marvin Miller, a labor lawyer. And the players' union, of course, has always opposed revenue sharing because they're concerned that with revenue sharing, the owners will have less incentive to outbid each other in a free agent market. And that, of course, is the history of the National Football League. And can you imagine also the National Football League rule about what happens when a player is injured being applied to baseball? If a player is injured in the National Football League and cut from the roster, he does not get paid. There is a player that the Yankees signed, Carl Pavano. He has been on the disabled list for 2 years. He's making well over $5 million. He's getting paid for not playing. So the strength of the players' union means that there's going to be considerable resistance to the National Football League model. But unless there is some kind of revenue sharing, we're going to continue to get the problem of some teams competing all the time and some teams basically not being able to compete, with the occasional exception of teams like Oakland or Detroit. Another thing to consider about large and small market. It was thought in the 1990s, after the success of Baltimore and Cleveland in building new stadiums, that if you had a sick franchise, all you needed to do was build a fancy new stadium and people would come to it. And that turned out for a while to be true. The Cleveland Indians had sellout after sellout after sellout in Jacobs Field. The Orioles had the same in Camden Yards. But it turns out on reflection that that's now only true if, along with this nice new stadium, you have a winning ball club. They're packing them in Comerica Park this year because the Tigers are winning. But Comerica Park is a fancy new stadium, and 2 years ago it wasn't drawing anybody. Cincinnati attendance with a new stadium is down. Baltimore attendance is shockingly down. If you want a good example of how to take a successful franchise and run it into the ground, follow the model of Peter Angelos with the Baltimore Orioles. The Orioles barely outdrew the Washington Nationals this year. And the Washington Nationals, as I said, are playing in Robert F. Kennedy Stadium, a much less desirable venue. So, in short, the economics of baseball are at a period where they need to do something. All right, now let me turn to the next issue, which is steroids. Baseball could not have managed an issue less well than it managed the steroid issue. Basically, what baseball did with steroids was, you remember after the baseball strike, in the mid-1990s, baseball attendance fell significantly. The public became estranged from both the players and the owners, and people just stopped going to games. Baseball officials were concerned that they might never recapture the sort of attendance that they had prior to the strike. And about the same time, players began to hit home runs with greater frequency. Players like Brady Anderson of the Baltimore Orioles, who was basically a person who contributed about 10 to 15 home runs a season, Brady Anderson hit 50 home runs in one season. players who were known to be defensive players, primarily in the major leagues because of their good defense rather than their ability to hit, were routinely hitting 20 to 30 home runs. And then, of course, we got the very hyped up home run record chases of Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa and Barry Bonds. The shape, the physical shape of baseball players began to change in the 1990s, and it was largely attributed to people working out more. But the physical shape of players went well beyond people who were working out. Something was going on, and the teams knew what was going on. Players were taking drugs like human growth hormone and steroids, which gave them increased body mass and also gave them greater endurance to participate in workouts. The primary effect of steroids, people will say who take them regularly, is that they make you that you're able to recover more quickly from overuse injuries. So you can work out more than you could if you weren't taking it. You also gain weight, you gain strength, but you're also, it's while you're doing this, you're able to work out more. Steroids, of course, have been a routine feature of football. The steroid issue has not been as significant in football. Why? Well, one reason is football doesn't keep the sorts of comparative statistics that baseball does, statistics across time, or doesn't value them as much. For example, suppose that a quarterback is breaking the record for the number of attempted passes in a particular season. That may well be because the quarterback's team is a weak team. On the other hand, suppose a baseball player is breaking the record for stolen bases or home runs. That record is compared with all the records of the past. Baseball is in the business of sort of comparing statistics historically. So steroids become an issue because Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa and Barry Bonds are threatening the home run records of Roger Maris and Hank Aaron and Babe Ruth. So what did baseball do? They decided to do nothing about steroids. They decided to have a drug testing policy that was ludicrous. Remember, this is a very strong players' union. There's no incentive for the players' union to want random, serious drug testing. And the owners basically decided that, look, these big home run records are putting people in the stands. People are getting all wrapped up, and they're paying hundreds of thousands of dollars for balls that are caught. Mark McGwire's 70th home run, Barry Bonds' 73rd home run. They're investing themselves in these home run records. They're going into the stands, and let's just not pay attention to this. Finally, baseball gets out of its not paying attention only because Congress holds hearings, basically says, if you don't do something, we're going to impose legislation on you. So Commissioner Bud Selig gets up and says steroids are a big concern and they're putting in a tough drug policy. But in the meantime, it turns out that every one of the leading home run hitters in the 1990s is identified with steroids. I don't want to say took steroids, but Sosa, McGwire, Bonds, Palmeiro all have the same common characteristics. A dramatic increase in the number of home runs they hit when compared with their earlier career. A change in their physical shape. And some rumors surfacing that they were involved one way or another with ingesting steroids. All right, so what is baseball going to do about this? Their current posture is to just ignore it. That is, what are you going to do with Barry Bonds' 73 home run season if it turns out, as I think is the case, but if it turns out that Barry Bonds is associated with taking steroids, what are you going to do with McGuire? What are you going to do with Sosa? What are you going to do with Pomero? These are players that hit a very large number of home runs. Bonds is very likely to break Aaron's record. How do you compare Bonds' record with Aaron if Bonds has been using steroids? And if you decide to invalidate steroid records, then how are you going to do that? There may be hundreds of players in baseball that have taken steroids. It's just that some of their records are not as visible because instead of going from 30 home runs to 60 home runs, they went from 15 home runs to 30 home runs. How about Brady Anderson? Brady Anderson's physical shape changed. Brady Anderson had a workout trainer. Brady Anderson hit 50 home runs in one season. How about Pudge Rodriguez? So what are you going to do? Are you going to go through each roster from the mid-1990s on and take out the records and put an asterisk with them or put an S next to them? And this may apply to pitchers. How do you know that a pitcher's better records weren't the result of steroids? So baseball is simply in a quandary about this. I don't think there's anything they can do that will successfully deal with the situation. They created the situation. I have no sympathy for them. But I think the result is going to be that these records are going to remain, and they won't even be labeled. I mean, it's ironic that Roger Maris's home run record for some years was included with an asterisk to signify that he played more games than Babe Ruth, but that all these home run records are not going to be so labeled when no one's accusing Roger Maris of doing anything except playing more games. He was not on steroids. So the steroid problem is just embarrassing for baseball, and it's largely insoluble. Okay, time for one more issue, and that's the ethnic and racial composition of the game. After Jackie Robinson was integrated into a Major League Baseball roster, we got a period beginning in the late 40s and extending to about the mid-1970s when African Americans increasingly emerged in the game. There were periods in the 1960s when the majority of players, starting players on American and National League teams, would be African American. Beginning in the 1970s, the number of African American players declined. At the same time, the number of Latino players dramatically increased. And beginning in this century, we've gotten to a point where there's more than a significant trickle of Asian players in the game. Now, part of this is simply the result of baseball's, as basketball, recruiting worldwide. As baseball is played in other countries and scouts are sent to the Latin American area or Asia, younger players are identified. Those players very often have strong economic incentives to sign baseball contracts at a very early age because they're coming out of an economically disadvantaged background. The teams take chances and sign these players because they are able to sign them for comparatively little money. And so you get Latin American and increasingly Asian prospects in the team's farm system. But that explains the influx of Latin Americans and Asians. The statistics, by the way, on Latin Americans are fascinating. In the All-Star game, All-Star rosters, 35% of the players were Latin American. On all Major League rosters, 25% of the players are Latin American. If you look at the Tigers lineup yesterday, they fielded 6 of 9 starting positions were Latinos. So that's one part of the story, and of course that's a nice part of the story. Baseball's becoming more inclusive. People from other countries and growing up in poverty are getting a chance to earn some money and help their families. But what's happened to the African American players? Why have they declined? It's not a question of their being beaten out for rosters on roster spots. It's a question of they're not showing up in the minor leagues. They're not showing up on college baseball teams. Why? Well, this is an indication of the competition that other professional sports are placing on baseball. Baseball is simply not being perceived in African American communities as attractive a sport to play as football or basketball. If you want to look at the rosters of the National Basketball Association or the National Football League, the number of non-African American players in the National Basketball Association that are not from other countries. In other words, the number of American white players in the National Basketball Association on rosters is very small. The number of white players on National Football League rosters is also very small. This is not a phenomenon that's often are discussed, because when you look at a football player, he's got all his uniform on. It's a little less visible as an African American. African Americans, in short, are flocking to those sports, dominating the rosters. Why aren't they doing it in baseball? Well, partly because gifted African American athletes have opportunities in basketball and football. And can make good money. But I think more fundamentally, baseball has not somehow retained its attractiveness to young African American males. It's just not, it's a sport that, for one reason or another, doesn't seem to appeal. Now, I think baseball has done a largely successful job in identifying itself as a sport that cares about its African-American players past and present. Jackie Robinson's number is retired. The Negro League Hall of Fame is publicized. Negro League players are inducted into the Hall of Fame. There's a serious effort to recruit African-American managers. So it's not that baseball is peculiarly racist in some way that football and basketball are not. But I think, nonetheless, baseball is not doing a good job of selling itself to young African-American males. I don't have any particular formula for this, but I think that the result is that baseball is just going to lose out in an important pool of athletes. They may be able to compensate for it with the pool of Latino athletes or Asian athletes. But I think it's a concern. If African Americans end up being a tiny minority on major league rosters in, let's say, the middle of the 21st century, then the sport, in a sense, is not as representative of American culture as it once was. I think, in conclusion, I think each of these issues is potentially troublesome to baseball. And I think that baseball's leadership has been, not to put too fine a point on it, pathetic. Their leadership consists of someone hired by the owners, a former owner, who makes no bones of being one-sided in his approach to issues. So Major League Baseball seems to be always somewhat behind the curve when an issue surfaces. I think they need to be much more proactive on all three of these issues, on economics, on steroids, and on the recruitment of black players. But I don't have any reason to think that they will be. So the prediction that I made in the 1996 book, that baseball will be in a kind of slightly declining position in American sports is going to continue in the next several decades. I'm happy to take questions. Thanks very much. The question is, to a baseball purist, the absence of a clock in baseball as compared with the dominance of a clock, let's say in basketball or football, is an attractive feature of the game. However, the length of the clock has resulted in baseball games becoming increasingly lengthy. Now, this could be addressed and stopped, and there would be two ways to do it. One would be for umpires to enforce time limits between pitches, prevent base batters from stepping out of the box and going through rituals, and being able to call timeout whenever they apparently choose if they have a favorable umpire. Stop pitchers from delaying in between pitching. And perhaps most importantly, cut down on the amount of time between innings. Well, why is there increased time between innings? Well, because the commercials are longer. So you'd have to regulate the sponsors. Don't think baseball is very likely to do that. But it's intriguing that about every 5 years, people, officials in Major League Baseball announce, the games are too long. We're going to make a serious effort to cut down on the games. We're going to reduce the time of the games from, we're going to try to get these games under 3 hours. You know, people don't want to be at the ballpark all night. And there's a flurry of activity, and they don't do it. But they should do it, in my view. Yes, sir.
More of an observation than a question, but baseball has always been dominated by studying statistics, and over the last 5-10 years with the rise of Moneyball and Sabermetrics and the way of following baseball kind of more in a statistical manner, there's been with that a rise in things like fantasy baseball. And, speaking from personal experience, that's been a way for me to engage in baseball in a way that I haven't been able to do in a long time. And I wonder if it's, I assume it's more of a generational thing, but I wonder if you have any thoughts on how following baseball virtually increase
attention
to the sport, and whether or not that's something that you see any noticeable
trends. The question is, would fantasy baseball and the idea of vicarious participation by fans through owning their own team or being the general manager of their own team, all of this being compiled on current statistics of players, would that help increase fan involvement? Well, I think the officials of Major League Sports believe that it will, because they are selling fantasy stuff very significantly. That is, I don't know whether you know about this phenomenon, but the sports talk shows are now having segments where they have so-called experts on fantasy football. And there's a column in the Washington Post that appears every Friday with a person who's a fantasy football expert. Now, I want to make a perhaps opinionated, well, certainly opinionated and perhaps provocative comment about fantasy sports. I've always felt that there's a certain kind of personality that vicariously participates in sports to a degree of intensity that's inappropriate. This is probably a very bad audience to make these comments to. I think if one has played sports at any sort of high school or college level, one knows that there's a kind of dark side to doing it. And part of the dark side is the intensity with which fans invest themselves when they're not players. There's a limit to which one can do. I mean, every day you get up and your body may or may not respond successfully. You have good days and bad days. You have days that you're in the zone and it's a wonderful time. You have days when you've just got wooden hands and you're clumsy and you've got no coordination. And that's part of playing sports. It gives you a certain balance towards sports. It makes you less of a fanatic once you stop playing and become a quote, fan. And my only concern with fantasy participation is that it will tie into a certain kind of intensity which might be fostered by the absence of participation of the person in the game itself. So that one begins to care more about a running back statistics than one's own children's schedules. So I'm a little worried about creeping fantasyism. But I think it may well be good for participation. Yes, sir. I think if the player, the question is there anything that could realistically be done about the economic problems in baseball given the strength of the Players Association? I think the answer to that is that gradually, if the Players Association could be persuaded that it would be in the interest of the players. It's not like the National Football League salaries are low. They might eventually take a more moderate position. But free agency is entrenched. The absence of significant revenue sharing is also entrenched. It would take a series of labor confrontations over the years, and I'm not optimistic about it. Yes, sir.
Somewhat of a comment related to this guy. My 20-year-old son says that two things really say baseball are fantasy baseball. He says, in this fantasy league of 20 guys, there are only five of them ever been to make them name. And of all people who, just like you said, aren't participants, don't participate, and they keep up the statistics. The other interesting thing is he says steroids, although are a real negative now, probably save baseball, and that it heightened the interest at a time when it was really declining. And yes, it's going to be a negative feedback to it, but it did get a whole new group of people involved in the excitement of the home run race and all that.
The observation suggests that, first, fantasy baseball has in fact attracted a group of people that would not necessarily attend baseball games or were not necessarily even baseball fans, but by having the fantasy experience, they become interested. And that the steroid era resulted in higher visibility for home run races and brought more fans to the park, and those fans have remained. Well, as to the latter point, I think the bringing fans to the ballpark and keeping fans in the ballpark is a function of having a winning team. And no team, even the Yankees, is invulnerable from that. Yankee Stadium attendance is high, but Yankee Stadium attendance has not always been high. When the Yankees had bad teams, Yankee Stadium attendance was very low. Red Barber, one of the great announcers of baseball history, was fired from the Yankees in the late 60s because the Yankees were owned by CBS at the time and they were doing very badly. And at the last game of the season, the attendance in Yankee Stadium was very, very small. Barber instructed the television cameras to pan the stands to see how few participants there were in the stands. And he said, the big story today is this. He was instructed in the middle of the game not to do that anymore by the owners, and he was subsequently fired. So if you have a bad enough team, if you're the Baltimore Orioles, and year in, year out, you don't sign free agents, or you make bad free agent decisions, and you don't improve your team, and you have a consistently mediocre team, people won't come. So the fact that they were at one point attracted doesn't mean they'll stay attracted. Now, as to the fantasy group, I am not, I am an analog person. I'm not a digital person. I do not fully appreciate, perhaps, the extent to which an internet world vicarious participation can become so embedded in a culture as to actually shape people's lives. But I defer to people who are more knowledgeable about this. I must say, I think it would be a sad state. I have a grandson. I think it would be a sad affair. Now, I have no prospect for my grandsons becoming interested, a rabid sports participant, because his father is not. But let's assume that through some freak of the... And his mother is supportive of his father. but maybe through some freak of the genes he will be. But I think it is more likely that his involvement with baseball will be of the vicarious fantasy phenomenon. I think it's a little sad if a young male or female is sitting in a room on a day like today looking at a computer rather than going outside and playing something. But I'm old-fashioned.
But you hit on a major problem right there. Nobody goes out and plays a sport anymore. They pick up a box, pick up a computer, and pull right to other things. The only point I'll make before you take that next question is, I can't speak for any other state, but I used to be a Dixie Youth official in the state of South Carolina. One of the problems for African Americans as well as other poor people is barriers to entry. The old age, you picked up an old bat, an old ball, and you went to some grassy place and played. In today's time, that field has to be pristine. The equipment, even cheap equipment, is too expensive for a whole lot of people. And I see that as a major problem today with barriers to entry at the youth level. Now, there's beginning to be more sponsorship, at least in South Carolina, from Nike and people like that, because they've seen a saturation point occurring in youth basketball. But it's going to take a lot more of that to sort of generate an interest in the youth down there, because they can go to any park and play basketball, and all they have to do is get a football and find a grassy place to play.
The observation is that it's barriers to entry that are causing lack of participation in some communities, less affluent communities. Baseball does require more equipment in the sense of a good field to play on. But moreover, there's enhanced expectations about equipment that are created in a sense by the sponsorship of other sports. I just want to say I agree with that observation. Question.
Do you think Congress will use its threat of removing the antitrust exemption to force Major League Baseball to make some of the changes that you've mentioned, particularly with regard to steroids?
Well, first, the question is, will Congress, using the threat of eliminating baseball's antitrust exemption, put some pressure on baseball on the steroid issue? First of all, let's talk a little bit about the antitrust exemption, why baseball has it. That is just a historical fortuity. There is no reason to believe that baseball is not commerce in the same way that other professional sports are not commerce. If you're engaged in interstate commerce as an enterprise, you're subject to the antitrust laws, except baseball. Why does baseball have the exception? It's because two generations of Supreme Court decisions codified the exception, and Congress hasn't done anything to remove it. I think the motives for Congress are just basically that congressmen like to be associated with a national pastime and feel they get some political cachet. I think for that reason, I don't trust Congress on the steroid issue. I trust them to make a lot of publicity about it if they think it's favorable to their political futures. But whether they'll actually do anything about it, I have my doubts. Yes?
What's your take on enforcing a salary floor in baseball? One of the problems I see is teams like the Florida Marlins barely spend enough to put a team on the field and end up collecting a lot of money from other teams that do spend a lot of money if they replicate that with the Yankees. If the owner seems more interested in just making money than providing a good product for his fans.
Well, there is, of course, a minimum salary requirement. The players' union has imposed, has enabled a minimum salary requirement. The minimum salary requirement for baseball is comparatively higher than for other sports, especially when you remember that these people are going to get paid even if they get hurt. I think your question goes to another phenomenon in the baseball market. What do you do about the owner, such as Jeffrey Loria, who just deliberately breaks up his team? If he puts together a team on a low budget and does well, then the players will ask for big increases, and when their free agency comes up, they'll demand higher brackets. So these owners then respond by dismantling the team. I think the answer is try to get people in the game who are better owners, but I don't think there's much you can do. An interesting phenomenon about baseball ownership is that most owners are people who have made a great deal of money in something else, who are not baseball people themselves, and who think of their teams as toys in a revenue stream. They may not care so much if their teams lose money, if their other enterprises are doing well. Or they may care a great deal about every nickel and dime. They're a different sort of owner, but on the other hand, it's very expensive to buy a baseball team. Most people can't afford it, and so you're going to get, quote, millionaires, billionaires buying teams. I wish retrospectively that Peter Angelos had not been successful in asbestos litigation. If Peter Angelos had not been successful in asbestos litigation, he wouldn't have been able to afford to buy the Baltimore Orioles. In which case, they might be doing a lot better than they've been doing now. Yes, sir, way at the back. I think Jeffrey Loria lost money when he sold the Expos to Major League Baseball, but that's very unusual. They very rarely do.
Yeah, we hear the problem of finances in there, but they always seem to make a whole lot of money themselves.
Yes, the owners often claim that they're losing all kinds of money. But the real question is the owner's corporate stream, including the team that he owns, losing money? These are very wealthy people. They don't typically lose money. And so we should not. On the other hand, the demands of the claims of the players union are inflated as well. But this is typical. This is typical economic behavior at the high level. If some of you are multimillionaires, you'll understand. Okay, time for one more. Yes, sir.
You alluded in the beginning to the fact that baseball attendance should increase, notwithstanding the high prices.
That's a very good question. It's very expensive to go to a baseball game. You take a family of four and go to a baseball game anywhere, and you're spending over $100 for tickets, plus all the expenses of feeding people and paying for parking. How can people afford season tickets if they're people of ordinary income? So what's the result of, how is it that the attendance is good in some instances? I think the answer is pretty easy there. And it's a phenomenon, it's a result of these new stadia. The new stadia have all included corporate boxes, attractive locations for corporations to buy seats. Games are often, quote, sold out when the stands are not full. Why? Because they've been purchased by corporations who use them for entertainment purposes. Going to the ballpark has become a form of corporate entertainment. And people don't necessarily watch the games. They sit up in Camden Yards, they have corporate boxes. There is access to beverages. You can or cannot watch the field, and people sit and chat. There's, after all, there's all this time in baseball between actions, so there's lots of time to talk. So you can talk about your latest deal, or you can talk about gossip in the neighborhood. You don't necessarily, you can watch the game as well. But it's corporate boxes that are driving that. It's a kind of fake attendance. The attendance figures do not reflect the actual number of people in the seats. Well, thank you all for coming. Appreciate it.